Hello?
Mr. Johnston, my name is Mike Jarrett. I'm writing a book on country music production. It's under contract for Wesleyan University Press, and I wondered if I could talk to you about your work sometime.
When is it going to come out?
It's going to come, well, it's I've got a due date of early spring to submit the manuscript, and it'll take about a year to put it all together.
Uh-huh. Are you going down there to do it?
Down to Nashville, you mean? I've been to Nashville a couple of times, but I'm not going down to Nashville to do it. I'm calling you from Pennsylvania here where I live and work.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm sticking around home and doing it and doing a bunch of phone interviews. And I started this project back in the mid-90s and dropped it. And then this series came out on this press where they're doing some oral histories, and I thought that this was a project they might be interested in. It's a story that hadn't been talked about. So
yeah,
that's
where I'm going to have a book coming out. I'm about 3 months or 4 months away from it.
Oh, okay.
So you can give me a call when you get ready to do it or whatever, and I'll see where I lie. If it lies okay, I'll be glad to help you. Did you do Billy Sherrill?
You know, I've got to call in to his sister. She's his gatekeeper right now. He's not feeling well. But otherwise, I don't have a phone number for him, but I haven't done Billy Sherrill.
When you talk to her or whatever, like, tell him it's Bob Johnston. And I want to say hello to him, you know, because I'm an old buddy of his.
I will do that, yeah.
I think he's the best producer in Nashville.
Well, I love his stuff, I tell you that, like you. As you're writing your book, did you ever work with Don Law down there?
No, I did not. Don Law ran that place for a long time, and then CBS was going to turn it over to Frank Jones.
Yeah.
And I told CBS if they turned it over to Frank Jones, I would quit, and they could get somebody else to do Simon Cohen, Dylan Cash, and everybody else I was doing. And so they had to give it to me.
Yeah.
And they said, don't say anything to Don Law, because he's been down there 40 years or whatever. And he made a bunch of good records with a bunch of good people.
Yeah.
Said, don't say anything to him. Keep away from him. And take it easy and take 3 years or 2 years to be careful with all the people down there, how you treat them and all.
Yeah.
So I said, okay.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I left the office and flew down to Nashville. Went to see Don Law, and I said, I got something to tell you, but I'd appreciate it if you wouldn't say anything to CBS because they don't want you to know. And I said, they're going to drop you and give it to me instead of Frank Jones.
Yeah.
And he said, are they? And I said, yeah. And he said, oh, Gary. And I said, I appreciate you not saying anything. And he got up and he went over and he placed a call to New York City to Clive Davis and Yetnikoff, whoever was available there. And so I got up and left, and then called the music trades, and they had 60 artists. He said take 2 years and drop them and all, and I dropped 30 artists in one fucking day.
Wow.
Marion Worth and that old woman that laughed and told jokes and shit like that.
Yeah.
So I did all that, and there wasn't a goddamn thing they could do about it because I had all those others.
Right, yeah. I don't know of anybody firing that many other people except for maybe Jimmy Bowen. You might have a tie
didn't
with
fire
him.
Fire anybody. What I did was I checked out everything and found that they were with publishers.
Oh, yeah.
And they would make a record. And each one of them would make $500. Or $1,000 or whatever, and there wasn't any room for anybody else.
Yeah.
And I wanted to bring Dylan and Cohen and all those people down there, so I just dropped all the fucking people and kept the good ones.
They had it all backed up. Well, was that an accident in any way? You said you put that call in to New York. Was that change between the old guard and then you was right?
I didn't put the call in to New York. I went to see him in Nashville.
Oh, you
told him.
Oh, I mean when you say you put a you called up there and talked to Clive Davis or whoever. And that's why I was wondering whether that changed from the old guard to the...
No, I never considered Clive Davis worth speaking to or getting a copy. So when we went in for the, I had John Hammond there who found all those people.
Right.
And Bob Mercy who ran the A&R thing, and myself, and that's all we needed.
Yeah.
I never paid any attention to them.
Well, what I was always, what I always found remarkable was that it was, to my eyes as a fan, it looked like that the Clive Davis years and the Bob Johnson years, it was just so weird that they sort of even were happening together because it seemed so opposite.
They,
I mean, just in time, it's, y'all seemed so opposite.
They had Gallagher, who was the genius with chocolate Hershey bar, and he did all of that, and then he came over and ran as president. He came over and got it all ready to go, and then that's when Davis came in later.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
But Davis never did anything. He never talked to anybody. I told my artists to keep away from him. I wouldn't let him in the room. I'd shut the door, turn the light out, or we'd go to lunch or something, anything to keep them out of there. And I told Dylan, I told all the artists, I don't want those motherfuckers there.
Right.
If you get them there, you don't need me there.
Yeah.
Because they can't. They have to have a set of rules, and it has to be adhered to. And Davis and Yatnikoff and all those people, they can't sing, write, play, dance, perform. They can do nothing but give you the wrong advice for your career and your salvation and steal all the money from you. That's what they did. In
sure.
The book in the Rolling Stone, you need to get it, it's 5 or 6 months ago. It came out, and the back of the book there's 3 pages. In one page, it's got one little house about an inch high, and that was the music industry's money in the 50s. Then we went to 60s. It got 200 houses. And then it went to 70. From 1970 to 1980, it's come down to where it was the same as in 1950 with one house.
Yeah.
And I've got all the people that ran it, the chairman and the president that ran it, they didn't list that. They just listed the years that it came down.
Right.
And it came down from 200 houses to one house.
Yeah,
and I'm going to do is my book is print the same thing, but I'm going to list who was in charge of it as it came down.
Yeah,
and all those cocksuckers think that they're wonderful and all the press they got and shit like that. What are they going to do when everybody finds out that they bankrupted it and fucked everybody?
Yeah,
since 1920.
Yeah. Well, I don't know who you're voting for president, but that's my fear about Mitt Romney, that's what he's done.
Well, I'll tell you, I think it's an absolute mistake for him to get up there and argue with Mitt Romney. I think what they ought to do is get up there with a sign and hold that sign up and say, here's the 10 things that they're going to do that we don't want to do. Number one, take all the food stamps away from you, from the poor people. They're going to do that, and we're not. They're going to take all the stuff away from you, and we're not. And they're not going to, and they're going to give the rich people all of your money and that they don't give to you. And tell them what they do, and there's nothing to argue about.
Yeah.
You can't argue. The guy gets up there and lies, and
right.
and Obama tries to argue with him. All he's got to do is put those 10 things there.
Yeah,
that's what they're doing, and taking women's rights away from them, and taking your grandmother and grandfather's home away from them, and have them go live with somebody else, and not enough food, and taking their jobs and outsourcing them everywhere. I mean, I don't understand. I don't understand why one person is voting for that. I understand the rich people.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But all that money, I guess that money is what's against them not voting. But I never counted the vote. I thought it was a joke.
Yeah.
When Gore announced to the American people that he had just won the presidency of the United States, and an hour later he said they made a mistake and Bush won it. They told him, I was with a goddamn two generals and a colonel, and they were in the same room when they told him that he wouldn't last through the night.
Yeah.
And he said, well, George Bush won.
Yeah.
And he won. And yeah. He announced it to everybody, and nobody said anything.
Yeah. What a fiasco! Yeah.
Oh man, it's just like, are you fucking, are you kidding me?
Right.
So I'm ready to move to Vancouver if Romney does get in.
I'm thinking Costa Rica myself, but
Costa Rica is good, but I got a family and I think Canada will be really good. They got everything up there, and they're intelligent.
Yeah.
And you can get a piece of hash with your coffee in the morning when you want to, if you want to.
And you don't have to learn to speak another language.
You don't have to learn to speak another language.
Or maybe not. Maybe the way you and I talk, maybe it's just another dialect or something like
that. Yeah, that's all it is, really, is another fucking dialect. Nothing. It's phenomenal.
Yeah.
To me, and all the shit. I remember I walked down one time, and David said, "What are you going to do next?" And I said, "Louis Armstrong." And he said, "What do you want to do that old nigger for?"
Oh man.
I said, "Well, you're too goddamn stupid to even talk to." And he said, "Well, you can't do it." I said, "Well, I'm going to." I said, "I'll pay for it myself." He said, "You can do two sides, but that's all you can do."
And you did two sides.
Yeah, and I did two sides with Louis Armstrong and Cabaret.
He was God.
He was. And he didn't know it, and I talked to his wife and used some people that he hadn't seen for a long time. And I told him I was going to be at the studio at 10 o'clock, and I showed up at 11:30. And he said, "What happened? You getting a wreck?" I said, "No, I was eating breakfast." He said, "You mean you made me wait an hour and a half in the studio with those peep musicians that won't talk to me when I get up to them? They'll just walk away?" He said, "I'm going to get rid of you and get rid of this, and let's do it. Let's do two sides, and let's just call it a day."
Yeah.
I said, "Good enough." He said, "Well, what do you want to do?" And I said, "Well, the clarinet player is DR or RD, something like that." I said, "Why don't you call him and ask him to kick it off?" And he said, "RD." He said, "RD," and RD turned around, and it was five people that he hadn't seen in 15 or 20 years that his wife helped me get.
Wow.
He walked over to me and gave me the dirtiest goddamn look, and I thought, "What is this?" And I looked at him, and I said, "You're not going to kiss me." And he said, "Yes, I am."
What a man.
Yeah, and he kissed me on both cheeks, man. And then we went in and cut Cabaret, and he was one of my favorites.
He had learned that in Europe.
Oh, I remember that kiss. I said, "You're not going to kiss me," and he was looking at me dirty. I couldn't figure it out, and then I thought, well, maybe he's caught on.
Yeah.
And with R.D. and he was quite phenomenal.
Yeah.
And he loved Cabaret. We only did it one time.
Yeah. One of the guys I did talk to in Nashville that you had worked with was Jerry Kennedy, who went on to be a producer, as you know. But you had him early on playing on sessions, right?
I had Jerry Kennedy. What happened is that I found out who was the best musicians in Nashville, and they were the ones who played for Chet and Owen and all those people. And I didn't know that they pretty well did their own thing, so I hired them and all. And when I got in, I went around to Grady Martin, the guitar player, and I said, "Can you play something, Grady, like an offbeat thing?" He said, "Oh, no, that wouldn't work." He said, I'll take care of it." And I went around and asked the piano, and he said, "No, that won't do." He said, I'll put something in there. We'll figure out what to do." Every one of them said the same thing. So I paid them all double, told them to rehearse the song, and I'd be back later. And I left and went to dinner and never came back, and I never saw them again except if they got paid double. And then I went out, and Reed, Jerry Reed's wife, just had moved into us, by us in Nashville down there. And she told Joy about these people, Ray Stevens and Jerry Kennedy and Charlie McCoy and all of them that had come up from Mississippi and Missouri and Arkansas and Arizona and all that shit. And I said, "Well, let me try them." So I was doing, my wife, old lady, was doing writing songs for Presley. She had 22 in those movies that they did. And I went up after getting that band to see if I could get them to do the demos. And I thought I didn't want to be 40,000 people out there with her on putting in stuff. So I got went out and got the Jardinaires and asked them if they'd do the backgrounds for me for demos. And they said, yeah. And then I got his band and I asked him if the band would play. And they said, sure. So he'd listen to 5 or 10 songs. And then all of a sudden, he'd hear the Jardinaires with his band and me going, hey, 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 baby, like that. And he'd say, that's the one I want. Because it was Watts' band and the Jardinaires, except it was my voice in there, and he figured he could sing better than me anyway. So that's what we did, and I learned how those people played. And then when I had a chance with Bob Dylan, I used them.
Now, did you have a conversation with him right at there at Highway 61 Revisited and said, hey, let's try
no,
these.
No, I never used them on Highway 61.
No, I'm saying that after that, did you say, let's go down to Nashville and use these guys?
No, I always said, let's go down to Nashville. First day I was ever with him, we walked in the studio and there was all the suits were there. And I was talking to him about Nashville and I said, good thing, and I fixed the studio down there and you don't have to fuck with anything. And I said, nobody will mess with you. And the engineers, I got that worked out. Well, we don't even have to have them, some bitches. And he said, he never would say, yeah, or good idea. So, like that, you know, like Jack Benny put his thumb on his lip like that. And he walked out. And Davis and Grossman, the manager of Dylan, and Getnikoff and all came over and said, if you ever mention Nashville to Dylan again, you're fired. I said, what? Why? What would that be? I was planning on bringing a bunch of people down there. And they said, they're stupid down there. And he said, we don't want you starting off with Dylan stupid in Nashville. And he said, just remember what we told you. If you ever go down there, you're fired. I said, good enough. You're the boss. So I took him down there about 6 months later and cut the best album in rock history.
Right.
So I really have no use for any of those fucking people.
Yeah, yeah.
None of them at all. They're all crooked. And what I want to know is where the artists are who have as much money as the record companies people do. Artists don't have any money.
Right. That's in another world.
A few of them have money. A few of them kept a little bit of here. They'll go out and make a show and get their money. But they don't have the millions and millions and millions of dollars that everybody was fucked out of.
Yeah. Yeah, that's in another universe.
That's another universe. And now it's going to be, we got a brand new company coming. It's going to be a big company. That's not for print, but it's going to be a real good company. And we don't take the artist's money. The artists have three banks, London, Vienna, and Switzerland.
Oh, yeah.
They have their banker, and they can call their banker and find out how much was put in there anytime they want to. They can have control over what they cut. And I'm not going to have a CD. I'm going to have a DVD. And everybody, and it'll be a record club.
Yeah.
It'll be like you'll cut four sides. Every artist will cut three sides or four sides a month and do a video with them. And the people on the club will get the record every 3 months. They'll get three sides. I mean, every month they'll get three sides or four. And they'll get a little video. And when 3 months is done or 4 months is done, they'll have the album without having to pay $30 at one time.
Oh, yeah. That's a great idea.
Yeah, one album, and then they can get as many as they want to. But isn't that great? Because I saw, with me, I'll bring home a CD, and then I'll play it for somebody, and then I'll put it up, and 2 weeks later, or a month later, I'll play a couple of songs again and put it up, and you won't see it for a long time.
Yeah.
With the DVD, they'll all see it because everybody has to have a video on, whether it's TV or their video or whatever. And if people had Rolling Stones and Bob Dylan and all like that, now what if they had the DVDs stacked up that they could play?
Yeah, yeah. I'd love that. Yeah.
Now, well, that's what I got planned.
That's a great plan. Let me ask you one more question about that. When you're playing those session players double time and all, if you knew, did you have any idea that something like Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands, or with a long song on Blonde on Blonde. Did you know how long they'd have to play, or did that come up that day?
That came up that day. He said he went in the studio, and he said, I'm going to write a song, and he wrote a song for a day, and then the night came, and then the next night came, and about 4 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock, he came to me and said, anybody awake in there? And I said, yeah, they're all awake. I went in, woke them up, they washed their face. And I told them to come in. I said, if you stop playing, get your suitcase and all your stuff and go on out the door, and you can get me a replacement, and we'll wait for it. But otherwise, I can overdub you all. I can't overdub Bob Dylan. So don't ever stop. Don't ever ask him to play what he is and rehearse it or something. We're not going to do that. You watch his feet. When he starts patting that foot and playing the guitar, you can follow him along. And I said, your job is not to play something that somebody tells you what to play in a goddamn country. Nobody is going to tell you what to play, and you play what you do. And
yeah,
the people are either going to say that's not worth a shit or listen to that goddamn band.
Yeah. Yeah, which is what they said.
And all they said was listen to the band.
All right.
And we
right.
made the first one, and what they did, they were all playing. I said, don't ever quit. And at Dylan, when he played his, and nothing in Nashville was ever done except for a 3-minute record. You couldn't have a.
You couldn't have anything that went on.
You couldn't have a 3-minute record. You couldn't have past a 3-minute record because they wouldn't play it.
Yeah.
So Dylan played the verse and the chorus, and then gave a big ending, like that was it. And everybody quit playing. And then he hit the next chord for the second verse. They didn't know it, and they jumped in again. 17 minutes later, we finished the song. Dylan said, did you hear that? And I said, that's what you got to do, hear it back. And we went in and played it back, and he said, Jesus Christ. And that was it. And we hardly, I don't ever remember cutting a song twice.
Yeah.
Al Cooper always wanted to. Well, let me overdub here. Al one day started, 1, 2, 3. I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm counting off. I said, nobody counts off for Dylan. Fuck, you're just wasting fucking time, man. You're not going to count off for Dylan. Nobody is.
No, you thought it was like the Ramones.
Yeah.
I'm going to be the guy that counts off.
Oh, Cooper always wanted to. He said, he'd be in there and he said, let me produce you. I can produce better than Johnson. And Dylan would be waving his hands behind his back. But he didn't want that son of a bitch producing it.
Well, do you have any words of wisdom for me on self-portrait? Because on that one, it looks like you've got a string section on one thing, and it's just an. I was listening to it the other day, and years later, it still remains. It's quite listenable, I think, but it's a mystery.
He called me one day, and he said, what do you think about me doing other people's songs? And I said, what a great goddamn idea. So he started picking up the Bible and country people and shit, and he cut a couple of albums full of what he wanted to cut and who he wanted to cut and how he wanted to cut it. There wasn't anything drove him to that. That wasn't some joke or ad or something. He grew up with a lot of that shit, and he just wanted to put it down.
But like with the strings, would you do that after you cut the vocal?
We cut everything. I overdubbed a little bit.
Yeah.
A few black voices and some strings that I had on. He said, just put the fill it in, whatever you want to do.
Yeah. Yeah. So
what I did.
When you got just these radically different concepts, like you go from
I was radically different always,
yeah.
And that's why everything I do is radically different.
And they knew that, and that was what attracted to them, you figure, after a certain point, certainly.
Them didn't attract anybody. Nobody had anything to do with that but Dylan playing his guitar and a couple of things that we did. And then he'd listen to what I did and say a few things sometime. And I don't remember how it happened, but it was put together like that.
Yeah. What was the deal with them not releasing that stuff like you can get so easily bootlegged with Dylan and Johnny Cash together?
It was so tragic that it was even hard to talk about. They wouldn't release that, and the reason they wouldn't release it is because Johnny said, "Give me my 45," and Dylan said, "Won't you give me my 45?" And they said, "You can't have talking in the middle of a record, and you can't have it where one says, 'Give me my 45,' and the other says, 'Won't you?' And you have to take a razor blade and go through and take every note that they wrote or spoke, take everything out, and then we'll release the music like it's supposed to be." And I said, "Fuck all you people." And I left, and they never released it for 20 years.
Yeah.
I heard it's going to come out in England or something like that, but mostly you can get it on bootlegging.
Yeah, well.
And that's why it didn't come out, because they didn't think they wanted me to take all the talking out. And I told Cash that. I said, "Give me a razor blade. I'm going to cut all that goddamn talking out."
Yeah.
And he said, "Over my dead body."
Well, they screwed up so much on those releases, you know, not putting stuff out, that it really, Dylan creates the bootleg almost with that.
He did create the bootleg.
Yeah. Yeah.
I cut 1966 in England over there, and they didn't even put my name on it. They said I wasn't there. I took my wife and two children, had a movie made with Dylan on the stage where it was.
Yeah.
And I got about 70 albums in there I haven't been paid on either.
That's all.
I got 132 accountants working on one thing in New Jersey, and they're going to go. They already closed down a bunch of companies. They're going to try to close all the record companies. In 1929, they started paying people, underpaying them.
Yeah.
And they kept it up until they didn't have anything, because you what they did is the way they do it is they send you in, and you make a record. And then they don't like the record you make. So then you have to make another one, and that puts you double or triple up. And then they'll put it out, and they'll say it didn't work, but we've got to have help. So there'll be two parties, one in L.A. and one in Florida, about $200,000-$300,000 a piece, marked off of the goddamn recording artist thing, not them. And they stick part of it in their pocket, and the rest of it they go out and have fun with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what they do, and the artists get nothing. So the artists are going to have their shit at one of three banks.
Yeah. Well, that's how they do with writing, too, you know, in lots of ways. You know, a record I love that you produce is Dan Hicks.
Oh, and the Hot Licks.
That must have been so much fun.
It was. He was drunk, and he had a dog, what do you put on around their neck and leash? He had a dog leash, and it was a big long one, and there wasn't a dog on it. And he'd walk around the town in Mill Valley with that leash, like, and he was crazy, motherfucker.
I love
him. Him and those girls with him and all. It was fun with them.
It was like a crazy retake of Western Swing and
everything. That's what he wanted.
Yeah. Yeah, I used to memorize those songs when I was young. They were so much fun. There was a lot of great wordplay in them.
And one last thing, just to show you, I don't want it in print until I come with my book, but just to show you what it is, Johnny Cash signed with Sun Records, Sam Phillips, and he went in the first day and told Sam that what he had was a marvelous idea, and he thought it would be his stairway to the star. And Sam said, "What is it?" And he said, "I'm going to go to a prison to record an album." Sam said, "If you go to prison to record an album, I'll either drop you or I'll make sure you don't record for anybody else for 5 years. It's a horrible idea, and it'll ruin your career, and forget about it." So he forgot about it. 5 years later, when he got all done, he went over and signed with Columbia. Said, "I got a great idea." He told them, and they said, "That's a horrible idea, and you can't do it. And if you do, we'll fire Johnson if he does it, and close the office down there, and we'll get rid of you. And you'll either not record for anybody, or you'll have to wait 5 years and record." So Johnny called me, told me he had a great idea, said, you probably won't like it either. And I said, what the fuck is it? He told me. So I picked up the phone and called Folsom and Quentin. Got to the Folsom, got to Warden Duffy, and I said, Duffy, you don't know me. My name's Josh, and I'm from Texas. And I said, I'm with Johnny Cash here. He said, holy God. And I said, Johnny Cash is going to come up and do a live record and a fucking concert for you. What do you think about that? He said, God almighty, when? I said, ask him.
Yeah.
So I handed the phone to Johnny, and I said, Johnny, talk to the warden at the Folsom and set it up. So Johnny set it up, and I left. I went to Florida or something. I got back, and about 5 or 6 days later, Johnny called me, and he said, I just called you to see if there was anything you could do. He said, CBS people came to me and said they'd fire you and get rid of me, and I couldn't record anymore for 5 years if I did that song because it would ruin me. And he said, I just wondered if you had any idea or nothing anybody can do, really, with those power structure people. But he said, I wondered if you had any idea. And I said, yeah, I got a great idea. He said, what is it? I said, if I was you, I'd quit mowing around here, and I'd go out, and I'd get me the biggest goddamn suitcase I could find, and I'd start packing the motherfucker, and I hung up on it.
Yeah.
And about a week later, he called me back. He said, when are we going? I said, 2 weeks. I never told them pluckers anything, man. We just got in a goddamn plane or bus and went up there and did the album, and they wouldn't release it, wouldn't work with it.
Yeah.
I went to see the guy in L.A., and he said, Blower and Drake, the two biggest people in California, agency for airplay, radio stations, all like that, they're the ones that needed to have it. And he said, Blake and Blower didn't like it. And I said, well, can I have a copy? So he got about 100 records and went through it, and down on the bottom was Johnny Cash. And he gave me the record, and I said, thanks a lot. So I called my buddy in San Francisco who ran San Francisco instead of L.A., and he flew to L.A., and we went looking for Drake and Blower and found them about 4 o'clock in the morning in an Italian restaurant drinking. And Chuck walked up and said, you don't like Cash's record? And they said, what Cash record? They hadn't even heard it. So we went back and played it, and they went on it all over the country.
Wow.
And I went back to that guy that said that Drake and Blower had heard it and all like that. And I said, you're a fucking liar. So I said, here's your check for $1,000. You got to cash it. And if you do, you're in susceptibility because I can go to any of those people and tell them you took payola and get your ass fired.
Yeah.
So you're going to do that, and you're going to go out, and you're going to break that goddamn record for me. And here's you $500 extra. Here's your check for $2,000. I said, now get your ass in gear. And I went out, and he went out and broke the fucking record.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it would have been laying there, and there wouldn't have been any Johnny Cash.
It would have been another bootleg.
It wouldn't even bootleg. Whatever the fuck they did.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, and he was the only one that went into Congress to talk about the Indian, too.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really a great thing.
The last time I saw him, I asked him, I said, are you ready for the third in the historical prison series? I said, we're going to Sing Sing. And he said, there's nothing I'd like better, but he said, my health won't do it. My health is bad, Bob, and I can't do it. I said, well, that's a fucking shame.
Yeah.
You could have had a troika there. He said, yeah, I know it, but I couldn't get into it. I couldn't hold up.
Yeah.
I said, well, you held up enough, man. You had those two.
Yeah. From a fan's point of view, it seems to me that Earl Scruggs was one of the most open-minded people down there in Nashville. Is that correct? I mean, he did interesting things with you, and he seemed to be willing to work with other people.
I always demanded that. I had together, with Earl Scruggs, I had Billy Joel, Albin Lee, Albert Lee, the bass player for the Blues Brothers. I had Sissy, Whitney's mama, that's with Presley. I had about 30 people down there, all of them in a room, and I'd go, we're going to do this song now. And Leonard Cohen would say, oh, let me sing on this one. And Billy Joel would say, well, I'll play piano on this one. And they'd all come in, and then I'd get together a bunch of them, and we'd do the song. And they went back somebody came over there and went back and said that I was using all those people over there, and a bunch of major artists were wandering around the studio and didn't know what to do. And so they came over to take care of it, and I locked all the doors outside, and they couldn't get in their own goddamn studio till I got through recording, which was 2 days later.
Yeah, yeah. That's exciting stuff. It sounds so good now.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That was a wonderful album. Yeah. Earl Scruggs' 25th anniversary album.
Yeah. I love those Train songs. I think there's a book to be written about how trains change the way we listen to music and the way we hear.
Absolutely, absolutely. I grew up in Joshua, Texas, and we had the train tracks behind us. And every night we'd get up and go down by the tracks and kick the cows so they'd get up and we could lay down in that warm grass and watch those people go by with a coffee and a big cigar in their mouth.
Yeah, yeah.
Before Cash wrote about it, I was watching it.
Yeah, yeah. I know it, yeah. Hey, well, listen, I'd love to call you back sometime after you finish your book.
Yeah, man. Give me 3-4 months to check out on this book here. They got it in the German fair today, Frankfurt fair. They got about 700,000 people that come on the weekend.
Okay.
And they sell books and buy books, and they're doing mine. Their mine's up for bidding now. They got 6 people that want it.
I can't wait to see it.
Starts about $150,000 a bidding, so it should be a pretty good one. Yeah, it's gonna be a good book.
Yeah, I can't wait. All right, well, it's a pleasure to talk to you, sir. I really thank you for your time, and I will call you back.
Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from York, Pennsylvania, is where I live.
York, Pennsylvania. All right.
Yep.
Nothing bad about Pennsylvania.
Nothing. That I know of. I'm from Atlanta and Chattanooga, though.
Are you?
Yeah.
I like Chattanooga. I don't like Atlanta.
I agree with you.
Never did like Atlanta.
I'm not that thrilled about Chattanooga, but I went to school there and all, so
yeah,
I had some fun.
Yeah, Chattanooga. My grandson's going to up in the mountains,
Rocky
Mountains up there, whatever that college is.
Yeah, yeah.
But listen, I'll let you go, buddy.
Thank you so much.
In 3 or 4 months, and I'll be happy to talk to you.
I'm going to do it. Okay, thanks a lot.
Bye.